Carolina, though not as an active duty soldier. He witnessed the continual bombardment of Fort Sumter from Morris Island, and in August wrote to his father, wishing the state of New York would give me an appointment to recruit for them. I could get a great many men. In the Sea Islands, Lewis saw the rich harvest of possible black soldiers for the Union Army. His brother Frederick Jr. was at that very time in Vicksburg, Mississippi, recruiting among former slaves, witnessing the human and natural ravages of war as he tried to enlist men from cotton plantations. For the 22-year-old namesake of his famous father, the world of the Cotton Kingdom under siege and devastation represented the revolution the elder Douglas had imagined. Nothing was more revolutionary than ushering former Cotton Belt slaves into Union blue. Details are elusive about just how Frederick Jr. functioned as a recruiter. Lewis, on the other hand, always had an eye out for how to make money from any circumstance, telling his father of offers of partnership in business as a sutler for the army. Charles Douglas, despite his recurring sickness, stayed in the army as long as he could, still trying to prove his courage and worthiness as a warrior. He was discharged from the 54th and transferred to the 5th Massachusetts Cavalry, where he served as a non-commissioned first sergeant. Through the awful summer of 1864, the delicate Charles served in Virginia during the early siege of Petersburg and at Point Lookout in Maryland, located at the southernmost tip of the peninsula on the western shore, where it meets the mouth of the Potomac River. Charles was now a soldier in the ranks of his dismounted unit, and he found his own real war. Black units of the United States Colored Troops were some of the first to occupy the City Point position, where the James and Appomattox Rivers meet. City Point soon grew into the biggest military depot and headquarters of the war. His regiment had mercifully missed the horrific battles of the Wilderness and Spotsylvania Courthouse in May, and they remained at City Point during the disastrous slaughter at Cold Harbor, fought just east of Richmond, June 1st to 3rd. On May 31st, in a letter to his father, Charles expected to be called into line of battle every moment, as he anticipated what became the beginnings of the siege of the city of Petersburg. With a soldier's trembling bravado, he told his father that our boys are anxious for a fight. As for myself, I am not over-anxious, but willing to meet the devils at any moment and take no prisoners. Luck was Charles's companion. His unit was kept largely in reserve on guard, picket, and logistical duties. Charles felt especially proud to report capturing a rebel prisoner while on picket duty. He also joyfully announced that they had brought in a large group of contrabands. He further reported an ugly tragedy. The commanding officer had to shoot one of the men for being drunk and misbehaving, but the bullet hit the wrong man. Charles dropped this pitiful irony almost as fast as he told it. All the Douglases learned that this great revolution had an underside of horror, terror, and futility. Later in the summer, Charles's health failed yet again, and he was transferred to the huge prison and hospital complex at Point Lookout. While stationed along the Chesapeake, Charles apparently took a brief leave, crossed the bay, and went to St. Michael's, where he became the first member of the Douglas family to connect with some Bailey cousins. The war crushed one world and reconnected another. What Charles may or may not have known is that his father, who had now developed a relationship with Abraham Lincoln, had written to the president in late August asking him to intercede and formally discharge his son from the army. "I hope I shall not presume too much upon your kindness," wrote the abolitionist to the commander-in-chief, "but I have a very great favor to ask. It is that you will cause my son, Charles R. Douglas, to be discharged." On September 1st, the president sent the letter to the War Department with the endorsement, "Let this boy be discharged, A. Lincoln." On September 15th, Charles wrote to both of his parents informing them that he was honorably discharged from the service of the United States and would be home within 2 weeks. Douglas had asked his sons to hear and follow his trumpet, to risk all for the cause of black freedom. Now, he also reversed course, and with emotions he never fully described, did whatever he could to save one of them. The summer and fall of 1864 were thus harrowing as well as hopeful months for the Douglas household in Rochester. They found great cause for personal relief, as both Lewis and Charles were out of the army, at least for the time being, and not in danger. Nathan Sprague still served with the 54th Massachusetts, but Rosetta, pregnant with her first child, resided at home under her mother's watch and care. Rosetta's daughter, named Anna Rosine Sprague, called Annie for Rosetta's deceased sister as well as her own mother, was born on November 27th, giving the Douglases their first of what would be 21 grandchildren. Although she probably retreated more and more now to her kitchen and garden, Anna Douglas happily had a new baby, Annie, in her house, as her husband, with no editor's desk to retreat to, pondered and wandered the new political landscapes of a nation at war. At the beginning of that bloody year, all three Douglas sons and one son-in-law had served at the war front in some capacity, while the patriarch himself rode the rails across the North on his mission to convince multitudes to fight the cruel war to its bitter end. All of Douglas's children had to imagine their own new homes in this time of all-out war and revolutionary change, as their father tried, with the words and deeds of a self-styled prophet, to influence history and power in the highest places. In practical terms, what Douglas meant in his mission speech by Abolition War was a military conquest of the South, complete emancipation, continued enlistment of black soldiers without discrimination, and legal guarantees of black freedom and equal rights. An abolition peace would mean the subjugation of the Confederacy's slaveholding and treasonous leadership, full black citizenship and enfranchisement, and a strong role for the federal government in protecting the freed people and in reconstructing Southern society. The war, this divine school of affliction, in Douglas's words, provided the signal and the necessity for a new order of social and political relations among the whole people. Preserving the old Union was but a miserable dream. What Douglas the visionary wanted was a fundamentally new republic. Hence, as early as any Northern politician, he pondered the nature of the potential post-war reconstruction. As early as 1862, Douglas counseled his readers to hold no illusions about the difficulties blacks would face when emancipated. Indeed, the problems of peace suddenly seemed much greater than the problems of war. If emancipation was accomplished, Douglas surmised, it would happen in great violence, and its aftermath might prompt even greater backlashes of violence. The sea of thought and feeling lashed into rage and fury by the war might foment a frenzied wrath among the defeated. After the fighting, Douglas suggested, will come the time for the exercise of the highest of all human faculties. A profounder wisdom, a holier zeal than belongs to the prosecution of war will be required. He wondered about uncharted constitutional terrain, about the use of federal authority in reconstructing state governments. Although he was no more prescient than the next person, Douglas envisioned Reconstruction as a long ideological struggle. "The work before us is nothing but a radical revolution," he declared in an editorial, "in all the modes of thought which have flourished under the slave system. A new order could not happen overnight. There is no such thing as immediate emancipation, either for the master or for the slave," he asserted. "The invisible chains of slavery might take generations to break," Douglas predicted with an uncanny, tragic foresight. Naturally, Douglas's wartime concern with Reconstruction centered upon the welfare of the freedmen, and he laid out a paradoxical prescription combining classic self-help with outside philanthropy and activist government intervention. His early answer to the question of what was to be done with the emancipated slaves was to do nothing with them. "Your doing with them is their greatest misfortune," he lectured his fellow countrymen. "Just let them alone." Slavery, he implied, had always been a measure of avaricious, powerful people doing too much with and to black people. In language modern anti-government conservatives, including Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas, have loved to appropriate and rip out of historical context, Douglas gave his prescription. "If the Negro cannot stand on his own legs, let him fall. Your interference is doing him positive injury." In 1862, Douglas expressed doubts about the Freedmen's relief efforts, although within a year he went on the lecture circuit to raise money for just such organizations, and even donated his speaking fees to the cause. Wishing for a world of fairness and merit early in the struggle, however, Douglas denounced what he oddly called the old clothes system of benevolence. He did not want the freed slaves to depend for their bread and raiment upon the benevolence of the North, arguing naively, in retrospect, that the freedmen would make it on their own if left alone. Emancipated slaves undergoing terrible hardships dearly needed to gain self-respect, but their need for food, clothing, medical care, and protection quickly became even more necessary. Douglass's insensitive remarks about Northern benevolence were short-sighted and misplaced at best. Later, in the 1870s, Douglass would preach a black self-reliance and a laissez-faire individualism that echoed the reigning social Darwinism of the day, and which may always have roiled under the mental surfaces of this proud, putative, self-made man. Such contradictions emanated from deep in the psychological well of a man who had so long himself relied on the financial benevolence as well as the emotional support of influential and wealthy white reformers, as well as the fundraising campaigns of his devoted British female friends. No one ever worked harder nor at greater risk for the liberation of American slaves than Douglass. But he had processed hard psychic lessons for years about loving and hating the hands that feed one's family, buy one's freedom, help educate one's children, and keep the printing press rolling. During the slaughter and displacement of the war, however, he soon found that the fate of the freedmen was a much more complex problem than the do-nothing rhetoric had implied. The tension between the doctrine of self-reliance and the necessity of government support for the freedmen produced a working paradox in Douglass's thought throughout the war and postbellum period. He never stopped arguing that the legacy of slavery would require federal aid to the freed people, but he also never surrendered his commitment to a fierce individualism. As both belief and strategy, he advanced both doctrines at once, a position of stark contradiction after the war in an age decreasingly receptive to humanitarian reform. While expecting a rugged self-reliance from his people, so many of whom emerged from slavery with little or no human or physical capital, he also demanded justice and fairness from the nation. In 1862, Douglass warmly called the government the shield from the fury and vengeance of treason, rebellion, and anarchy. In every discussion of the welfare of the freedmen during the war, Douglass insisted that the government deal justly with blacks. Douglass assiduously advocated for both bootstraps and aid, all the while learning that among the many casualties of the total war were impulses of humane fairness. What Douglass meant, in large part, by do nothing was do justice. Coupled with his calls for black self-help were his demands for education, wages, protection in the workplace, civil rights, and suffrage. All of these aims would require extraordinary use of federal power, new laws, military enforcement, and fundamental changes in social attitudes. He expected a great deal from revolution wrought by the war. In millennialist historical thinking, the limits of change are in God's imagination as much as in mankind's. We would not for a moment check the benevolent concern for the future welfare of the colored race in America, wrote Douglass in 1862. But we earnestly plead for justice above all else. But by 1863, justice was a many-headed, bloody dream as it underwent rebirth. From Northerners, Douglass wanted less pity and more ballots, less benevolence and more black land ownership. He would never be comfortable with any widespread confiscation or redistribution of Confederate lands in the wake of the war. Instead, he wanted freedmen to obtain land by means consistent with the sanctity of private property, although in his view, the government ought to have a primary role in securing and arranging the sale of such land. With time, Douglass applauded every function of the Freedmen's Bureau, the unprecedented federal agency created in early 1865 to try to provide massive social welfare to the millions of black and white displaced people in the South. But when emancipation itself was still a revolutionary policy in the making, he He seems to have concluded that white audiences needed strategic preparation that would feel consistent with their worldviews. "What shall be done with the 4 million emancipated slaves, if emancipated?" Douglas asked. "Pay them honest wages for honest work. Dispense with the biting lash, and pay the ready cash. Awaken a new class of motives in them. Remove those old motives of shriveling fear of punishment, which benumb and degrade the soul, and supplant them by the higher motives of self-respect and personal responsibility." Then Douglas shifted the point of view decisively. "They, blacks, have been compelled hitherto to regard the white man as a cruel, selfish, remorseless tyrant. Now let him see that the white man has a nobler and better side to his character." This was thoroughgoing political liberalism sprinkled with twists of old-fashioned moral suasion. It was not economic radicalism. The substance of Douglas's message to white Americans, therefore, was morally change yourselves. The new order was as much for whites to give as it was for blacks to take. Douglas knew that the prospect of emancipation had always needed sweetening in northern ears, just as it had in numerous other nations and empires. The do-nothing dictum might allay white fears. He portrayed blacks as hard-working people who only needed simple justice and a fair chance. Land ownership would make each of them a better producer and a better consumer. Northerners need not fear massive migrations, vagrancy, or criminality, Douglas contended, if blacks were given equality before the law. Douglas believed blacks had been perceived as an exception too long, and he wanted to prevent their becoming permanent social pariahs. What do-nothing meant, in part, was to free the slaves without colonizing or subjugating them as a racial caste, then give them equality and allow them to learn, work, and vote. Douglas demanded governmental action, not merely letting the freedmen live or die by their own pluck. Douglas feared a vindictive spirit sure to be roused against the whole colored race in an imagined post-war South. He repeatedly called on Northern reformers to improve the condition of the former slaves. Whenever the shooting stopped, the whole South, Douglas declared, as it never was before the abolition of slavery, will become missionary ground. Capturing the spirit of freedmen's aid societies, Douglas urged reformers and teachers to walk among these slavery-smitten columns of humanity and lift their forms toward heaven. The freedmen's needs would require what the orator called all the elevating and civilizing institutions of the country. Modern Republicans, eager to find a black spokesperson for personal responsibility, have not bothered to read deeper into Douglas. As Douglas addressed during wartime the question of Reconstruction, he more and more stressed black suffrage. With the war nearing its end in April 1865, he gave an address to abolitionists in Boston entitled "What the Black Man Wants," in which he outlined at length the reasons why his people needed the vote. He contended that women as well as men have the right to vote, but in the moment, women must wait for another basis to gain suffrage, a position that would ultimately land him in a bitter feud with many women reformers. The ballot, he believed, would serve as protection from white racism, a means of education, and a source of self-worth. Douglas treated suffrage with special urgency at the war's end. The opportunity might never come again in anyone's lifetime. "This is the hour. Our streets are in mourning, and under the chastisement of this rebellion, we have almost come up to the point of conceding this great, this all-important right of suffrage." Hence, with prophetic insight, Douglas urged abolitionists to harness for all time the extraordinary forces the war had unleashed. "Judgments, terrible, overwhelming, are abroad in the land," he counseled. "I fear if we fail to do it now, we may not see for centuries to come the same disposition that exists at this moment." Whether an abolition war could ever be waged to its conclusion was very much still in doubt in the bloody summer of 1864. The revolution could still be lost. In the election campaign of that year, Douglas continued to be troubled by the ambiguous policies of the Lincoln administration. Conflicting factions within the Republican Party vied to influence and control the evolving emancipation, as well as Reconstruction policies. Postmaster General Montgomery Blair, the old leader of colonization, would accept emancipation of slaves in reconstructed Southern states, but opposed any political or civil rights for freedmen. He did so in fear-mongering, Negro-phobic public speeches, claiming without authority to speak for the president, as Blair warned against racial amalgamation. He traveled the North with a message as anti-black as it was anti-slavery. He called the abolitionists' advocacy of equality a fundamental change in the laws of nature, blending different species of the human race. He continued to advocate for the colonization of liberated blacks to their own natural climes and hemispheres. The other wing of Republicans, the more ascendant radicals, led by Congressman Henry Winter Davis of Maryland and Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts and others, wanted immediate emancipation, followed by the beginnings of equality, including black suffrage. Lincoln sought, above all, to sustain party unity, to make emancipation a certainty, although by gradual and orderly means if possible. In late 1863, Lincoln had responded to a Michigan Republican who had urged him to move faster against the conservatives by saying that he hoped to stand firm enough not to go backward, and yet not go forward fast enough to wreck the country's cause. This was the Lincoln who had exasperated Douglas in 1861-62. And as the war collapsed into horrible stalemate in 1864, Douglas lost faith for a time in whether he and Lincoln had ever worked from the same script. One of Lincoln's greatest concerns was chaos or even guerrilla race war in the South as the war ended. Douglas insisted that secure land ownership, and especially the right of the freed slaves to vote, would be essential buttresses against that very disorder. Lincoln feared potential white violent resistance to blacks voting. Douglas believed black Southerners would need to be armed with the vote to protect themselves. Both men would in the long run be proven right, but in what order and by what pace ought this revolution take place? On that question, they greatly disagreed. Douglas possessed his own vengeful spirit to work through, and Republicans struggled for consensus. As the presidential election campaign of 1864 approached, Douglas found himself attracted to a Dump Lincoln movement among radicals in the Republican Party. The most contentious question that divided Republicans against themselves was Reconstruction policy, as well as perceptions of Lincoln's indecisiveness and conservatism. A good deal of scurrilous political ambition drove passions for a new candidate as well, especially that practiced by the Treasury Secretary, Salmon Chase. Chase's desire to unseat Lincoln was a wide-open secret among the political class. Lincoln had long needed Chase for his skill as an administrator and his anti-slavery credentials, but fully understood that he was infected with the White House fever. Chase had allies, but primarily he relied on a somewhat broad discontent among radicals with what they variously considered the president's temporizing approach to slavery and the prosecution of the war. Widespread contempt also simmered under the surface because of Lincoln's frequent joking habits and character. Chase, in persistent efforts to damage Lincoln, had openly complained that cabinet sessions were merely meetings for jokes. On policy, many radicals objected to Lincoln's lenient approach to reconstructing Southern states and rendering justice to Confederates. Lincoln, however, was popular outside Washington, D.C., and across the North. Moreover, Chase faded from the picture by the spring and early summer of 1864 due to his own embarrassing overreach. After numerous offers by Chase to resign his cabinet position, Lincoln finally accepted the fifth time. A more serious challenge to Lincoln's nomination came from a group of radicals who touted John C. Fremont for the head of the Republican ticket. Fremont, who had been the Republican standard bearer in 1856, collected many abolitionist supporters, including some old Garrisonians. Garrison himself, however, broke with his friends and steadfastly stayed in Lincoln's camp. Wendell Phillips called Lincoln a half-converted, honest Western Whig trying to be an abolitionist. Garrison, however, believed that despite his caution, Lincoln had, at one blow, severed the chains of 3,300,000 slaves. Douglas walked a fence in this politically dangerous terrain. He endorsed the call for the Fremont Movement's convention, but did not attend when it met in Cleveland on May 31st to nominate the Californian for president and John Cochran, the nephew of Gerrit Smith, as his running mate. Disgruntled and painfully impatient with Lincoln administration ideas about black equality and Reconstruction, Douglas decided to join the attack. The unequal pay controversy in the Union Army burned among black troops and their communities until midsummer, and the federal government showed no disposition to grant black suffrage in such occupied southern states as Louisiana. Even before announcing his proclamation of amnesty and Reconstruction in December 1863, Lincoln had communicated forcefully to his commanding general in Louisiana, Nathaniel P. Banks, that he desired a tangible nucleus of Unionist leaders of whatever number, which the remainder of the state may rally around. This was the kernel of Lincoln's vision of Reconstruction, a fluid experimental process, a part of military policy run by the president and not by Congress, and heavily dependent on his faith in an inherent Unionism within the Confederate States. A local, loyal white elite, therefore, must not be threatened off by the prospect of black suffrage. The president's evolving Reconstruction policies made him appear passive or even obstructionist to radicals. Certainly, Banks looked so as he conducted elections in early 1864 with the vote restricted exclusively to white men, and as he instituted a plan to force black freedmen to work for wages capped by the government at $10 per month. Banks's system also included prescriptions that freedmen remain on their old master's plantations in perfect subordination, disciplined often in the old methods of slavery. White and black radicals within Louisiana and across the North were outraged. Some abolitionists stationed with the army in Louisiana condemned the Banks measures as the re-establishment of slavery or the substitution of serfdom for slavery. As Lincoln, by and large, supported the Banks system, Douglas joined the chorus of anger and frustration. Asked to explain in May why he supported the Fremont movement, the orator laid it on the line as an uncompromising radical. Douglas demanded complete abolition of every vestige, form, and modification of slavery in every part of the United States. Leaving no room for experimentation and gradualism, he insisted on perfect equality for the black man in every state before the law, in the jury box, at the ballot box, and on the battlefield. He wanted nothing short of full equality for blacks in access to offices and honors in the military and the government. After emancipation in 1863, Douglas had hoped he would never again have to attack Lincoln. But in June 1864, he wrote a stinging public rebuke of the president. It was now a swindle that the federal government asked the respect of mankind for abolishing slavery, all the while practically reestablishing the hateful system in Louisiana. Douglas had tried to believe in Lincoln's steadfastness, but now his patience and faith dwindled. The president had virtually laid down this as the rule of his statesmanship. Douglas boldly stated, "Do evil by choice, right from necessity." He chastised Lincoln for not signing Congress's Wade-Davis bill, which was the radical Reconstruction plan requiring a majority of voters in a Confederate state, as opposed to only 10% in Lincoln's plan, to renounce secession and declare a loyalty oath before returning to the Union. Douglas called Lincoln's 10% plan an entire contradiction of the constitutional idea of the Republican government. Especially incensed with Republican hostility to black voting rights, Douglas slashed away at his old targets of hypocrisy and racism. "We invest with the elective franchise those who, with bloody blades and bloody hands, have sought the life of the nation, but sternly refuse to invest those who have done what they could to save the nation's life." Most demoralizing of all, he argued, was what government policy implied for the freedman once peace arrived: to hand him back to the political power of his master, without a single element of strength to shield himself from the vindictive spirit sure to be roused against the whole colored race. From the Democrats, who were about to nominate former General George B. McClellan as their candidate, and from the Fremont third-party effort, Lincoln's reelection was in dire trouble that summer. War weariness had never been so debilitating across the North. Abolitionists remained split over whether to support Lincoln's reelection as the casualty reports from Virginia and Georgia drove Northern morale into despair. The situation was never so gloomy, wrote Sidney Gay, editor of the National Anti-Slavery Standard. He feared that the people would vote for any compromise or follow a party for peace at any price, even disunion. A war that might not be won for union surely could not secure the emancipation of slaves. Douglas followed Lincoln's public utterances in these months, but he surely could not know the beleaguered president's personal thoughts. On one compelling matter, however, they unknowingly shared a great deal: the effort to discern and explain, if possible, the place of God's will in this horrible, unending conflict. With differing style and scope, Lincoln and Douglas shared an outlook of millennial nationalism: America as a nation with a special destiny, fraught with contradictions, and living out a historical trajectory under some kind of providential judgment. Lincoln's House Divided Against Itself and Last Best Hope of Earth had long been Douglas's nation of shameless hypocrisy, its hands full of blood, but also the nation so young, its original great principles so old and profound, that it could yet be redeemed. Both men possessed pliable, deeply curious minds, and they were intellectual brooders. Both expressed ambivalence about theological orthodoxy, but neither could imagine human affairs, history itself, without the idea of an active God shaping its direction and outcomes. Both kept watch over history and worried intensely about a vengeful God's interest in the American Republic. Their individual paths to the dark crisis of 1864 were both riddled with expressions of such a religious historical worldview. Lincoln, writes the biographer Ronald White, typically thinks his way into a problem, looking at all sides and working through the logic of a syllogism. Douglas, too, loved to logically weigh two sides of an issue, and like Lincoln, he possessed a well-earned respect for mystery and uncertainty. Through irony, he often gave the impression that he knew precisely where he would land with a typically thunderous argument. Douglas could logically and pragmatically think his way to his truths as much as the quieter Lincoln. By 1864, both men were intellectual self-reinventions of earlier selves, and both envisioned the nation in biblical terms, undergoing transformation by fire. In late 1862, Lincoln had warned the nation, "We cannot escape history. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down, in honor or dishonor, to the latest generation." 2 months earlier, Douglas had in his own way said the same. "We are saved as by fire. We grieve with sorrow-stricken families all over the North, but their terrible afflictions and heavy sorrows are their educators." As another biographer, Richard Carwardine, has demonstrated, the withering demands of Lincoln's cruel presidency swept him along to a new religious understanding. His wartime language increasingly included claims of his firm reliance on the divine arm, that he sought light from above, was acting with responsibility to my God, and that he hoped to discern God's wishes in the signs of the times. Lincoln very possibly, in 1864, famously scratched on a fragment of paper what his secretaries and future historians would call his meditation on the divine will. No better example exists, except for his second inaugural address, for which this statement provides a foretaste of Lincoln's austere, biblically informed sense of tragedy. "The will of God prevails. In great contests, each party claims to act in accordance with the will of God. Both may be, and one must be, wrong. God cannot be for and against the same thing at the same time. In the present civil war, it is possible that God's purpose is something different from the purpose of either party. I am almost ready to say this is probably true, that God wills this contest, and wills that it shall not end yet. He could have either saved or destroyed the Union without a human contest. Yet the contest began, and having begun, he could give the final victory to either side any day. Yet the contest proceeds." Lincoln's private reflection invokes a profound sense of the costs and the tragedy at the heart of this human contest. Characteristically, Lincoln couched his emerging sense of a frightening truth in words such as almost and probably. Douglas, while sharing the same ideas, was rhetorically beyond qualifiers. Ever since his first autobiographical writing, he had conducted his own meditation on divine will. He protected his own uncertainty, perhaps more rigidly, by rooting it explicitly in the rhetoric of Isaiah and the Hebrew prophets. Douglas's wartime apocalypticism breathed with Old Testament fire and justification. He frequently employed phrasing such as the laws of God, the stern logic of events, or the trade winds of the Almighty to give both tone and substance to his explanation of the war's meaning. Douglas's subject was less the shaping of policy than it was to persuade a people to rise, make holy war, and answer God's call to repent and sacrifice. The land is now to weep and howl amid 10,000 desolations, he cried early in the war. Repent, break every yoke, let the oppressed go free, for herein alone is deliverance and safety. Douglas repeated his great wartime theme over and over. The mission speech was his Jeremiadic, prosecutorial summation. A chosen but guilty people had to suffer and reform or lose their destiny altogether. Douglas decided that his best options were to stand with Isaiah and Jeremiah and issue the warnings about God's intentions. His people might be listening at this moment as never before. We do not know just how or whether Lincoln or Douglas prayed, but by late summer of 1864, both men, facing this existential predicament from different positions, solemnly pondered what course God might have in mind for this terrible war. Lincoln's famous public letters and addresses, where he showed his commitment to emancipation, may or may not have had a role in softening Douglas's ire toward the president in 1864. But in August, Lincoln stunned Douglas by inviting him to the White House for an urgent meeting that, in the view of the black leader, would change almost everything once again. Lincoln's notion to invite Douglas to Washington emerged out of his meetings during the week of August 10th through 17th, with John Eaton Jr., a New Hampshire-born, Dartmouth-educated chaplain of an Ohio regiment in the Union Army. General Ulysses Grant had appointed Eaton superintendent of freedmen in 1862, and by 1864, the minister had established a large number of contraband camps in the lower Mississippi Valley. On his way to Washington that month to brief the president and the War Department, Eaton had heard Douglas deliver the mission speech in Toledo, Ohio, and had conversed with him about it afterward. Few people understood the plight of the freed people on the ground in the South, quite like the devoted abolitionist Eaton. In reminiscences of his meetings with Lincoln, Eaton found the chief executive's interest in the situation of freed slaves astonishing. Worried about the military stalemate and the process of emancipation, Lincoln, according to Eaton, alluded to John Brown's raid, openly suggesting that every possible means ought to be considered to maximize the liberation of slaves. The president asked about a grapevine telegraph that might be utilized to call upon the Negroes of the interior peacefully to leave the plantations and seek the protection of our armies. Here was some version of Brown's old militarized underground railroad, the idea that almost drew Douglas to Brown's band of ill-fated warriors. Eaton informed the president of some of Douglas's criticisms voiced in Toledo, especially about the leniency of the Reconstruction Plan, the lack of action on black suffrage, and retaliation against cruelty to Negro soldiers. Lincoln abruptly rose, went to a private desk, drew from a drawer, and read aloud a copy of his March 13th letter to Governor Michael Hahn of Louisiana, in which Lincoln suggested that the elective franchise might be extended to some colored people, the very intelligent, and especially those who have fought gallantly in our ranks. Defensively, Lincoln beseeched Eaton, did Douglas know about this letter? Further, could Douglas be induced to come see him at the White House? Arrangements were quickly made, and the Rochester orator, on the road constantly that summer, was on a train through Maryland to the Baltimore and Ohio station at New Jersey Avenue and C Street in the Capitol. As Douglas sat in the reception room at the White House awaiting his interview with the president on August 19th, Douglas had a chance encounter with Judge Joseph T. Mills of Wisconsin. who was also awaiting an appointment. In his diary, Mills recorded telling the president the story of how dark it felt in the reception area. So dark that, there in the corner, said Mills, I saw a man quietly reading who possessed a remarkable physiognomy. I was riveted to the spot. I stood and stared at him. He raised his flashing eyes and caught me in the act. I was compelled to speak. Said I, Are you the president? No, replied the stranger. I am Frederick Douglass. Douglass had been stared at in countless such situations before, and we can only imagine the stern eyes and proud, if indignant, voice with which Douglass responded to this kind of encounter. Mills found the episode so humorous that in his conversations later with Lincoln, while sitting next to him on a sofa, he told of seeing Douglass, Mr. B., are you in favor of miscegenation? Mills recorded. That's a democratic mode of producing good union men, and I don't propose to infringe on the patent. In such an exchange of stares between an educated white jurist who supported the Union war effort and a smartly dressed black man reading as he waited to speak with the President of the United States, we can discern an old and enduring form of American racism still alive in parlor talk. What is that black man doing in the White House? How did he get there? We can hope Lincoln ignored the joke. In Douglass's second meeting with Lincoln, this time at the president's invitation, the two had a longer and remarkably frank exchange. Douglass had not minced words out on the circuit about Lincoln, accusing him in the mission speech of heartless sentiments and an absence of all moral feeling on too many questions. Policy, policy, everlasting policy, Douglass complained in an unveiled swipe at Lincoln, has robbed our statesmanship of all soul-moving utterances. Lincoln seemed aware that he now sat face to face with a fierce but useful critic, a situation this politician had managed many times before. Twice during their interview, a secretary interrupted to tell the president that Governor William Buckingham of Connecticut was waiting at the door, but in Douglass's memory, Lincoln kept dismissing the intrusion and said, Tell the governor to wait, for I want to have a long talk with my friend Frederick Douglass. Forever proud of this highlight moment in his career, Douglass relished retelling it. Lincoln quickly cut to the chase and unburdened his fears that he would not be reelected, that the war could collapse into a negotiated peace, and that, especially, emancipation would grind to a halt. Lincoln, recollected Douglass, was deeply troubled by all the attacks he received from fellow Republicans. The president looked much older than the last time they met, and he spoke with great earnestness and much solicitude. Lincoln, who later that day swapped a Sambo story with Mills, according to the judge, looked Douglass in the eye and asked the former slave to help him devise the means most desirable to be employed outside the army to induce the slaves in the rebel states to come within the federal lines. Lincoln sought Douglass's advice on how he should answer his critics, and especially on how to usher as many slaves as possible out of the border states into freedom and security before the election and the president's potential defeat. As Lincoln talked, Douglass must have leaned forward with a stunned visage. He saw in the president a deeper moral conviction against slavery, he later said, than he had ever imagined. In Douglass's retelling, Lincoln asked the former co-conspirator of 1859, who had fled America for his life, to undertake the organizing of a band of scouts, composed of colored men, whose business should be somewhat after the original plan of John Brown, to go into the rebel states, beyond the lines of our armies, and carry the news of emancipation, and urge the slaves to come within our boundaries. Douglass listened with profoundest satisfaction, and perhaps even disbelief. Overnight, it seemed, Douglass had gone from frustrated outsider and fierce critic to special presidential advisor and organizer of a radical military mission, the purpose of which was to destroy as much of slavery as possible before political fortunes changed. We cannot know what Douglass felt in his heart that morning as he looked into Lincoln's eyes, nor can we know fully how the old prairie lawyer processed this irony-laden moment. For those hours, at least, the former slave from the Tuckahoe and the Indiana dirt farmer's son were making a revolution together. After leaving the White House, Douglas returned to the home of a black friend with whom he stayed while in Washington. Eaton met him there and found the black leader pacing in a parlor in a state of extreme agitation. Douglas was both thrilled and troubled. The plan he had just agreed to help Lincoln and the army implement was inchoate and daunting. It also meant that the legitimacy of the Emancipation Proclamation was utterly dependent on military success, and therefore on the election. Douglas felt exhilarated to have been treated as a man, and with no thought of the color of our skins, by Lincoln. But frankly, he had little idea of just how to lead the plan to infiltrate the South, inform slaves, and funnel them north to safety. Suddenly, the man of supreme eloquence and hard rhetoric had to think about policy, organization, and clandestine logistics. Eaton said Douglas already had pen and paper on a table nearby, preparing to draft a memorandum to the president. A day or so later, before leaving the Capitol, Douglas received a White House messenger, accompanied with a carriage, inviting him to join Lincoln for tea out at the Soldiers' Home, the presidential summer retreat within the District of Columbia. The orator had a speaking engagement and had to turn down the invitation, something he would always regret, especially after the terrible events of the following April. We do not know what Lincoln had in mind for discussion at that tea. On the very day Douglas met with Lincoln at the White House, Julia Crofts wrote from England, full of anxiety over all the wretchedness and misery and bloodshedding of the war, and begging her old friend to not go toward Washington during this time. Your life is one that would be sacrificed at once if you ever reached the hands of those Southern tyrants. By the time Douglas read that letter, however, he had already drafted an outline of a plan for the president. On August 29th, the old editor sent his four-part proposal for a general agent, himself presumably, sub-agents selected by Douglas, stationed in various densely populated slave areas of rebel states, conducting squads of slaves into the North. Close ties and clear orders between commanding Union generals and sub-agents, and finally, proper provisions of food and shelter for all freedmen swept up in the liberation scheme. For himself, he wanted a roving commission, giving him full legitimacy amid the army officers throughout war zones. This was Douglas's best effort at a formal proposal for the militarized Underground Railroad in the midst of all-out war. He told Lincoln that he had consulted several other black leaders in the mere week since their parley. All believed in the wisdom of the idea, he reported, but only some thought it practicable. Although willing to lead such an operation, it is unlikely Douglas felt much practical enthusiasm for it. Just how he would coordinate his band of scouts, as he later called the idea, he never made clear. Soon, events rendered the entire scheme unnecessary. On September 2nd, the day the Democratic National Convention in Chicago nominated George McClellan for president, news flashed across the country of the fall of Atlanta to General William Tecumseh Sherman after a long siege. Just as the Democrats met to declare the war a failure and crafted a platform that would lead to a negotiated Confederate independence of some kind, Sherman famously sent a telegram to Washington. Atlanta is ours and fairly won. Confederates' rising hopes plummeted, and many war-weary Northerners, represented by the famous New York diarist George Templeton Strong, saw victory now on the immediate horizon. Glorious news this morning. Atlanta, taken at last. It is the greatest event of the war. The Democrats' peace platform put Lincoln's apparent moderation in a different light, and Douglas had seen a devotion in the president's heart and mind. By late September, Fremont withdrew from the race, and the choice simplified. When there was any shadow of a hope that a man of a more decided anti-slavery conviction could be elected, I was not for Mr. Lincoln, Douglas wrote to fellow abolitionist Theodore Tilton. But as soon as the Chicago Democratic Convention, my mind was made up, and it is made still. All dates changed with the nomination of Mr. McClellan. Like other abolitionists, Douglas wanted to actively campaign for Lincoln's re-election, but sensing the clear Republican desire not to be identified as the nigger party, he stayed away from the political stump. Some things had greatly changed, and some had not. The Negro is the deformed child, Douglas complained to Tilton in September. Put out of the room when company comes. The orator still had to find his own psychic balance between the high of the Lincoln interview in late August and the low caused by the subtle and blunt indignities of Republican cold shoulders in September. For now, those racist stares were not as important as winning the war and achieving universal emancipation and the right to vote. But the school of affliction was hardly over. As Douglas had learned so many times, in the election campaign and its historic aftermath down to the end of the war and beyond, he had to keep rethinking the tragic wisdom in Job. The Lord not only giveth and taketh away, but history itself, even in its most convulsive leaps forward, giveth and taketh away. Chapter 21 Sacred Efforts. And the dove came in to him in the evening, and lo, in her mouth was an olive leaf plucked off. So Noah knew that the waters were abated from off the earth. Genesis chapter 8, verse 11. During the final months of the Civil War, Frederick Douglass's emotions and ideas careened from fear to exhilaration, from hope to despair, and in and out of Old Testament-style tribulation and redemption. In a special address to a black convention in Syracuse in October 1864, Douglass tackled many of the war's personal and existential meanings. This national gathering, the first such convention to be held in 9 years, attracted approximately 150 representatives from 18 states, including small delegations from Mississippi, Missouri, Florida, Virginia, and North Carolina. The delegates collectively denounced colonization and explicitly demanded equality before the law. Possibly no previous convention had drawn a list of African-American luminaries of such diverse backgrounds and talents. Virtually every major black religious, political, literary, or community leader attended. For nearly 4 days, all manner of rivalries were largely checked at the door, while such men as Henry Highland Garnett, William Wells Brown, George T. Downing, John Mercer Langston, Jermaine Logan, and others matched wits over the great issues of the war, equality in the army for black soldiers, the dire necessity of complete abolition as the war's aim, equal civil and political rights in the aftermath of emancipation. These men were both former slaves and freeborn. Some were longtime friends of Douglass's, and others had already spent much energy as his rival, a trend that would only increase in the post-war era. Douglass's closest black comrade, James McCune Smith, ill with the beginnings of congestive heart failure, did not join the 53-member New York delegation. The delegates elected Douglass as their president. He was ushered with great applause to the stage by the younger, Oberlin-educated Langston. Douglass swiftly announced in his sonorous voice that the cause which we come here to promote is sacred. He envisioned the wide, wide world watching them as they promoted no less than the freedom, progress, elevation, and perfect enfranchisement of the entire colored people. On the following mornings or evenings, the convention would begin with prayers by the Reverend Garnett or others, and strikingly with song, including John Brown's Body, Blow Ye the Trumpet Blow, and on the final day, Julia Ward Howe's recently composed Battle Hymn of the Republic. How moving it must have been to hear full-throated renditions of such paeans to the emancipationist vision of the war and of the old Exodus story. At least one woman, Edmonia Highgate of Syracuse, addressed the convention, introduced by Douglass. The minutes do not record her speech, except to say that Highgate urged the men to steadfastness in the cause until the glorious day of Jubilee shall come. Most poignant of all, at the afternoon session of the second day, Garnett took the lead in unfurling across the platform the battle flag of the 1st Louisiana Colored Troops, a unit that had achieved fame for its bravery at the Battle of Port Hudson in July 1863. Delivered on the final day of the convention, Douglass's speech was both celebration and warning. Since the Republicans did not want him out on the stump campaigning, he delivered his own political accounting to his fellow African Americans on this election eve. He addressed the question of history itself, bounding forward, it seemed, to illuminate new barriers and obstacles to progress. In eloquence tinged with anger and anxiety, Douglas appealed to his own people, but especially to the generic you of white Northerners about to go to the polls. Nations could learn righteousness from supreme crises, he argued, and this was a moment when mourning mingles everywhere with the national shout of victory. Douglas asserted that the opportunity to crush slavery, throw back racism, and reinvent the American Republic around principles of racial equality may not come again in a century. Everything was at stake in defeating the Democrats and finishing the war. Douglas provided a litany of the horrors that would result if the Democrats, allied with Confederates, managed a negotiated peace settlement, resulting in the reestablishment of the white man's country and the obliteration of all the lessons taught by these 4 years of fire and sword. Douglas portrayed the Democrats as the enemies of mankind and of history itself. They were the fiendish hellhounds ready to pounce on black people and their allies at their first grasp of power. They had cleverly cultivated the political landscape with what the next century would call Orwellian language. Avoiding the words slavery or slaves or slaveholders, Douglas maintained, Democratic doublespeak sought the perpetuation of slavery in their platform under the guise of such verbiage as private rights or the basis of federal union or the Constitution. Douglas took up the meaning of friends and enemies, claiming to be as worried about the Republicans' hostility to black voting rights as to the Democrats' darkest aims. It is not the malignity of enemies alone we have to fear, he announced, but the deflection from the straight line of principle by those who are known throughout the world as our special friends. Douglas worried about possible peace plans that might get consummated before slavery legally ended. As though directly addressing Congress and a re-elected President Lincoln, he employed a moving refrain 4 times in a single paragraph calling for the 13th Amendment. We implore you to abolish slavery, he sang out over and over. Only then, he believed, would slavery's destruction and the national welfare achieve everlasting foundations. Then Douglas signaled what would be for him a primary argument throughout the post-war era. He demanded in the classic terms of political liberalism, the franchise as the greatest of all rights. Arguing from natural rights, moral doctrine, Douglas contended that in a republic, all elements of liberty, personal freedom, the right to testify in courts of law, the right to own, buy, and sell real estate, the right to sue and be sued, depended for protection on suffrage. The vote, said Douglas, was the keystone to the arch of human liberty. But he also accurately anticipated that the black male vote would bring great political value to Republicans in the post-war era. The only guarantee about a post-emancipation order in the South, he said, was the sullen hatred towards the national government and the freedmen on the part of ex-Confederates. Theirs would be a sacred animosity toward their conquerors, black and white. We may conquer Southern armies, proclaimed Douglas, but it is another thing to conquer Southern hate. The only weapon available was the votes of 4 million new friends. With these astute strokes of war propaganda and moral philosophy, Douglas awaited the election results. The convention delegates in Syracuse had good reason for anxiety over the presidential election of 1864. They had keenly observed events for months as the 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery, supported by Lincoln, had passed in the Senate, but failed of the 2/3 majority in the House of Representatives. With the war in terrible military stalemate in Virginia and Georgia, Lincoln and his administration fell into turmoil over its own emancipation policy. Peace Democrats relentlessly attacked Lincoln and emancipation as the obstacles to ending the bloodshed. His reelection in danger, the president authorized an ill-advised informal peace mission to meet with Confederate representatives, but the effort backfired on Lincoln. He allowed the nettlesome Horace Greeley to go to Niagara Falls, Canada, in July, and meet with what turned out to be bogus Confederate representatives. Lincoln crafted a brief letter addressed infamously, to whom it may concern, declaring that any proposition for peace would be received from Confederates as long as it included reunion of the states and the abandonment of slavery. The Niagara letter was a public relations disaster. Confederate sympathizers in the North, known to their foes as Copperheads, and the Democratic Party newspapers seized on this news and pilloried Lincoln as the bloodthirsty war maker standing in the way of peace in order to free slaves.